I wanted academic, strong academic backing when it came to counseling my patients about sex. So I didn't want to come from my personal experience sleeping with lots of people, you know, like that's valid. I mean, don't get me wrong. That's 100% valid. And I think it's amazing. But as a healthcare provider and as a professor, I wanted to make sure that the information I was providing my patients were evidence-based, backed by research and, and academic, academic rigor.
Yes.
So that was very important to me.
Yeah, no, I agree, because like you said, like personal experience is valid, but unfortunately it does not reflect the whole population. And welcome back. We are on today with my guest, Dr. Ushina, aka UC, on I'm Too Old for Dish It podcast. I'm Angies, the founder of Angies.com, link in the show notes, where I'm a health coach. If you want to work with me, you can get in touch via the website or email directly at hello@angie-s.com. So a little update from last week's intro. I found out I had been charting in other countries after 4 weeks into releasing this show. So I also want to say a big thank you to my listeners in Belgium, Canada, and the US for getting me there. So thank you, thank you, thank you so much. So just so you know, I'm finding about all of this now that I'm out of the charts. But, you know, it goes up and down. I think it's normal. But seriously, mega, mega happy and grateful. So thank you so much for your support. And now I will be opening up those emails notifications about the charts. So thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. A little minor update. I also mentioned that I may be changing the name of my health Instagram account. And I did. It's now called Not Too Old For, with the number 4. As in, not too old for good health. You're not too old for good health. That's what it stands for. So a thank you to Paul Lagan for your genius in coming up with a new name. And yes, that's it. Let's go straight into it. So today I brought Dr. Ushina, aka UC, on to talk about how to become more sexually intelligent and how to better communicate it with our partner. UC was so easy to talk to. She is absolutely lovely. And I love that she supports her knowledge with actual academia and makes it relatable by being her candid self. So without further ado, let's begin. Welcome, UC.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be with you guys.
I'm so excited. Thank you so much for joining us today. So I've saw you on Instagram and I've watched quite a few of your videos, and I brought you on because I just love how fun, helpful, and to the point you are on educating your audience on sex. And you're just like really fun, quirky, sexy, and intelligent. So before we dive into all of the questions, please introduce yourself, where you live, and what you do.
Oh my goodness. Well, I live in Austin, Texas. I was born and raised in Dallas, Texas, actually. And I am a pelvic health physical therapist, but right now I'm assistant professor at the University of Texas Dell Medical School, as well as adjunct faculty at the University of Michigan and their School of Social Work for their sexual counseling certification program. And I'm also a sexuality and AASET, so the American Association of Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, sex counselor. So that is all of my titles and all the things that I do.
Wow, that's really impressive. So
and I forgot. I'm so sorry. I'm founder of UC Logic, a sex education platform for adults.
Yes. Okay. Amazing. Yeah. That's actually the account I found you on Instagram. That's the website. Yeah. And you've actually got this great t-shirt on that says resist.
Oh yeah.
I definitely urge people to go and see it. Like you've got a great website. So
thank you.
You're welcome. So, okay. So you're very busy. You've got a lot of balls up in the air.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you around like the sex therapy and the sex ed. How did you get to be a sex educator? Like how, and a sex therapist, what's your story behind that?
Yeah, so it's fascinating. So the reason I became a physiotherapist or physical therapist is because I wanted to treat people who had pelvic floor dysfunction or sexual dysfunction. But in the education system, there weren't a lot of tracks where I can learn about sex and sexuality. So I take a class here and there. And I finally went to the University of Michigan, where I did this certification program, and it was training over a year where I learned about the didactics of sex education and sexuality and health. And that's when I felt I could serve my patients and eventually clients better, because I had all this extra training in addition to my healthcare training to address their sexual needs. Because I think for a lot of people, they forget that your sexuality, your sexual health, the way you view your sexuality is part of your overall health. And if that's not being addressed, you don't view yourself as healthy as you would for someone who isn't struggling with sexual issues.
Yes, absolutely. And it can also not just like on our physical health, but also like our emotional well-being as well, which absolutely is part of health, you know?
Absolutely.
Can you explain to listeners what you mean by didactic? You said,
Because I wanted strong academic backing when it came to counseling my patients about sex. So I didn't want to come from my personal experience sleeping with lots of people, you know? Like, that's valid. I mean, don't get me wrong, that's 100% valid. And I think it's amazing. But as a healthcare provider and as a professor, I wanted to make sure that the information I was providing my patients were evidence-based, backed by research and academic rigor.
Yes.
So that was very important to me.
Yeah, no, I agree, because like you said, like personal experience is valid, but unfortunately it does not reflect the whole population. And so until you have like enough data to gather to understand actually, you know, you can sort of start to name a dysfunction and help that dysfunction, whatever it is, you know, and yeah, I get it. That's why it's so important to get education behind what it is that you're talking about. It does make a big difference. So to give like the listeners some context, what are the dysfunctions that people come and see you for?
Primarily people come in to see me because they have pain, pelvic pain. So pain in the genitals, the vagina, the penis, the anus, abdominal pain, pain with orgasm or arousal. They may come to me with urinary incontinence, fecal incontinence, constipation. All of those things impact your ability to express yourself sexually or enjoy yourself sexually, even though it may not direct, like someone may say, how does urinary incontinence impact my sexual function? Well, if you're afraid that you're going to pee yourself all the time, do you think that you're going to be your best self in the bedroom?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Or if you feel like you smell like urine, you're not going to feel so sexy.
Yeah, absolutely. And also like with constipation, or if you have like, you know, that you're not going to feel comfortable because, you know, you're probably like going to be bloated and gassy, and it's just, you know, it feels really uncomfortable and can be, you mentioned pain with orgasm, like, like people actually having pain while they orgasm.
Absolutely. They might have pain during orgasm or after orgasm, and it can be excruciating for some of these people. Wow. They're in pain for several hours or a couple of days.
And is it the orgasm that actually triggered the pain? Like,
yeah, so it can come in different flavors. Sometimes the pain is already initiated with the act of sexual play.
Yes.
And then when they have the orgasm, it just makes the pain even worse. Some people are totally fine during sexual play, but then once they have the orgasm, it's like, watch out. So it just depends.
Yeah, because obviously, you know, painful intercourse, you know, that's something that, you know, I think, I mean, a lot of people have experience with, but I've never heard of like actually orgasm being painful, because we associate it so much with it being pleasurable. That's, oh wow. So how do you even start? Is something you can help with, like you can treat?
Oh, absolutely. So this is where that's actually a great question, because this is where the education has to begin with my patients and clients about how they look at their sexuality. Because a lot of times people ask me, what pill do I take? What injection needs to happen for this to stop? Yeah. And I said, you might actually benefit from a pill. You might benefit from an injection, but we first need to look at this from a biopsychosocial model, meaning instead of it just saying, oh, what's physically wrong with me? It's what's going on in your entire life that's impacting your sexual function, right? Because if there are things that are causing a lot of stressors, psychological blocks, that can manifest itself physically on top of whatever physical issue is going on. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. Like, that's like a little theory I have in my head. And I don't know, I was just thinking about this when you're talking about the painful orgasm. And this is going to come across quite mean if someone is actually in that situation. So I'd like to apologize that it's not meant that way. But, I wonder if, do you think sometimes those pains and discomfort can be triggered because you are with a partner that's not healthy for you? And I don't mean healthy in a biological sense. I mean, emotionally.
1,000%.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay. Because sometimes, she knows better. I'm telling you, sometimes she's like,
absolutely.
And I say she, that's my pussy. It's like, it's almost like she's depressed afterwards. I'm like, why is she so sad? I'm like, oh, the guy was wrong for me. And sometimes she's just happy for no reason. I'm like, okay, calm down. But it's like, she knows, you know what I'm saying? Like,
she always knows. So, yeah. Madam Pussy knows what's up. She knows what's up. And I think that, and not to say, and it wasn't mean for you to make that statement, because that's part of the differential diagnosis, right? That's part of the things that I'm thinking of when I'm talking to my patient. It's like, what's going on in your life?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you and your partner are really struggling right now, right? And when did these symptoms begin? You know, all of that plays a part, right?
Yes.
Is it the only part? Maybe. Is it a small part? Maybe. It just depends on the individual.
Yes.
But if they discount that completely, then they're never going to get better. And that's part of my job, is to make sure that my patients and clients really are well educated as to what's going on in terms of just the idea of sexual dysfunction and what's going on in their bodies and how those two are linked together.
Yeah. This is interesting. I wasn't sure I was going to ask you this question, but now that we're talking about this, do you think that, you know, unless there's a medical reason that this would happen, do you think that sometimes if someone's like, you know, feeling blue or depressed, like Madame Pussy would be like dry for no reason, like just even if like you want to, like she'll be like, no,
absolutely,
I'm out.
Absolutely.
And it's not always because you're going through menopause or whatever, it's just because she's just sad too. You know,
absolutely. I mean, context is king, right? Or queen, or everything in between, right? It is the ruler of all. And, you know, and I, you know, just to make a point, there are a lot of physical causes for why people have pain with orgasm. It's not just only psychological.
Mm.
My point is to say that it's all valid. I just think people really underestimate the emotional, psychological, sociocultural, interpersonal components in their life and how that they come in to the bedroom oftentimes.
For sure. Like, I think in health, it's all encompassing. Like, it's never just the stress or never just the physical. Sometimes it is just one thing. Like, you know, if you're born with like, you know, genetic variation or anything like that, it's just like something. But if not, often it's all the little things that add up. And all of a sudden you're like, why am I feeling this way? And it's all these little things have added up. So, is it people of all ages that come and see you?
Yes. The youngest patients I see are age 15, but the oldest I see, and they're not necessarily coming in for sexual dysfunction. They're coming in for issues like urinary incontinence, fecal incontinence, pelvic pain due to endometriosis or primary vaginismus or vulvodynia, you know, things like that.
And so you help them with like pelvic floor exercises and that kind
of stuff? Well, it depends.
If they're incontinence.
Yeah, it depends, because, you know, sometimes, a lot of times when people think of pelvic floor physical therapy, they often immediately think about Kegels. And what you have to remember about the pelvic floor is that it's part of a system, right? It's attached to the base of the pelvis, supports the spine and your hips, your abdominal muscles, everything. So if there's imbalance amongst those muscles that are attached to the pelvic girdle, your pelvic floor isn't going to function properly. So sometimes I may not get to a pelvic exam until session 4, because we're working on other things that I know are influencing their pelvic floor function.
Yeah.
And those are important components as well. So it really, I wish I could say I do this one thing every time with each patient, but it really just depends.
No, yeah, of course, it'll vary.
Yeah.
I mean, it's because like when I went to see, this is now, I think it was like in my 20s, late 20s, but I went to see in London, it was called, and I don't know if they've changed the title now, but it was just I can't remember how they said, a physiotherapist, but specialized for women. So basically like pelvic floor therapy and stuff. And so when she explained to me, you know, how the pelvic floor, like the, you know, that's it. There's nothing underneath to support it. So that's why like it's important to to look after it, you know, whether it's like learning to relax it or to strengthen it if the muscles are weak and stuff. And she explained to me about, you know, running, how that wasn't great for women, you know, if you run a lot, and you know, anything that's like bouncing up and down and stuff. Is that something that is still valid till this day, like after all the research?
I would say that running is good for everyone if they like to run.
Yeah.
The pelvic floor is a very, very resilient muscle, and it is meant to hold your organs inside of you. It's meant to help you with defecation, urination, sexy time babies. So it's very capable. So running isn't bad for the pelvic floor. Sex isn't bad for the pelvic floor. None of those things are bad for the pelvic floor. The thing about it is your pelvic floor, some people are prone to develop pelvic floor dysfunction more than others. Yes. And that can be more genetic component to that, environmental, you know, it could be due to surgery. It could be due to having a baby. So there are many components. So I think that perspective that the physiotherapist you saw many years ago had at the time was valid, but now has been expanded upon.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Yeah, yeah.
Because I always encourage my patients to be physically active, do what they need to do. Movement is key with your pelvic floor.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess, like you said, like, you know, when someone comes and see you as well, like, you know, you'll bring awareness, and with awareness, you then can train the correct way, you know what to do with it, you know, how to make it healthier and stronger for yourself, you know, so that,
absolutely,
you know, that you can age gracefully and feeling good, you know?
Absolutely.
So I want to talk a bit about your Bourbon Tales, which is a spot on your website and on Instagram, which is the part where, I guess, how like in the evening after, you know, when you come back from work, from university and stuff, and you go in and it's you, a question from, you know, one of your readers or listeners, viewers, and a glass of bourbon. Yep. And so within that context, actually, first of all, I need to ask you, do you actually drink the bourbon?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, 100%. I am not playing. Like sometimes it's in a mug because I'm drinking a hot toddy or something like that. Or I don't have anything else clean. You know, it just depends on what's available.
No, it's good because like it's just, yeah, it makes it super relatable. And it's funny because it's only when I went onto the website, I saw all your, you know, all your qualifications, all the stuff that you do, you know, I was like, oh, wow, you know, because you're so chilled and very relatable on your videos, and they're very fun to watch and they're great. And so how did you come up with that idea, like of doing the Bourbon Tales? How did that happen?
I think because, you know, I'm not a stranger to a good time with alcohol. And I think I've always loved bourbon. I love Manhattans. Like I don't like it when people don't make my Manhattan right. And I'm the first to send it back.
What's a Manhattan made of? Like how was
it's vermouth, bitters, and bourbon.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
And that's it. And you stir it. You don't shake it. That's amateur hour. If you shake it, you need to stir it. And you need like a nice cherry in there. And it's perfection.
Okay.
And there are different variations of it, but you know, anytime I see someone shaking my Manhattan, I always say, please don't do that.
Yeah. So I really like a whiskey sour.
Oh, so nice.
Oh, yeah,
so
I love it. It has to be made with the egg. Don't give me the powder.
I will not order it.
I'm like, I always ask, is it made with an egg? Because some places, you know, they will do the powder. I'm like, No.
Yes.
Give me salmonella.
I want it all.
That's what I want. Yeah, exactly. So that's why the reason why also I brought this up, because I want to transition a bit around like the pleasure part, which is what you actually talk about in the Bourbon Tales a lot. A lot of those questions are around, you know, what do I do? I'm in a relationship. This has been happening. How do I talk to the guy or the woman or, you know, whatever? So a lot of it is, from what I understand, is that you're talking about becoming more sexually intelligent, which in turn, like, will increase our pleasure and our mood. Mm-hmm. So my question is this, like, if someone is feeling like there could be more to sex, but they're shy to explore, or they're shy to ask for what they want in bed, how would you advise that person to start?
Yeah, Well, you know, that's really interesting question. And I actually get that question a lot. And I always say that you have to start with yourself.
Yes.
Because when you get comfortable with exploring your sexuality with yourself, you become a lot more comfortable in speaking your truth and asking for what you want. And also you become better at identifying a partner who can be receptive to that.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, but how do you ask? Because I've asked this question a few times on this podcast, uh-huh. and so I'm not obsessed.
But how do you ask your partner?
How? Because I don't know. Like maybe is it? I don't think I've got the tone down, or maybe I should be asking outside of the bedroom, like or outside of sexy time, wherever you have it. But I don't have a long-term partner as well. So I think that's probably also the issue. So like, you know, when you don't know, you know, when you're sort of just dating and it hasn't been long, it's a bit, you know, maybe more awkward. But how do you bloody ask? Because when I ask, I'm like, I'm not doing it right. I'm telling you, like, how?
Well, it depends. Yeah, it depends on the individual, right? So let's roll. So for example, like if I'm going on a date with some guy, right? Or we've been dating, but we're not exclusive, you know.
Yeah.
I might say, you know what, and I'm just making this up, but it's like, you know what, I really like for you to like play with my nipples more.
Yeah.
You know, I really like to explore that. I really want to explore anal play.
Yeah.
Like, are you down for that? Because I have some anal plugs that I'd like to try and I want that, you know, inside of me while we have sex.
Yeah.
You know, that having that discussion, not in the moment of sex, because depending on the situation, I think it's, but also not at dinner either. So in an intimate space where you're kind of starting to get, you know, handsy and touchy-feely.
So not in front of the parents.
Right, not in front of the parents. Yeah. But I think you can have that discussion like that, but it does depend on the person, right?
Because
some people you're dating, it's a lot easier to broach this topic with them. And some people it's not as easy. And so you have to be a little bit more strategic. But I've done it that way where it's like, we're kind of making out and be like, you know, I'd really love for you to do this to me. You know, that's really, that what really turns me on and what really gets me hot is when you do, like when we do X, Y, and Z. Right.
And like, but how, like, you know, like it's like in more, almost like in the details. So for example, if they're touching you and they're like, you know, let's say they're fingering you or they're going down on you. Sometimes it's like you just need them to maybe like stroke downwards or sideways, whatever you like it. And sometimes just those directions, almost like those are the really difficult ones to sometimes explain, because when you do it yourself is one thing, but sometimes it's hard to even know, like, how do you explain it? Sometimes you explain it, don't take it well. I don't know.
Well, okay. So here's what I do. And I hear you. So here's what I do. In those situations, I say, you know what, baby, it feels so good when you do this. And then I like guide their hand that way.
Yeah.
You know, oh my gosh, keep going this way. Don't stop. Keep going. Or less pressure, sweetie. Yep. You know, like almost. And if they get upset, I'll be like, okay, let's finish. And then we'll talk about it. Because I'm telling them, I'm basically giving them the answers to the test of my orgasm.
Yes.
And if they can't receive my explicit instructions, then they don't need to be playing with my pussy.
Yeah, absolutely.
End of discussion.
Yeah.
That is me personally, but people are in different spaces, right? So like, if you're married, if you're in a monogamous marriage, right? Like, you know, this is it. You're only partner for life, okay?
Yeah.
It's a little different, right? You don't have the flexibility to be like, no thanks, moving on to the next sex partner.
No.
Right.
Yeah.
And in that situation, especially if you've been with your partner for a long time and it's just not working, you almost want to kind of reapproach it from, hey, let's do some spring cleaning. Let's pleasure map. And I like this a lot, where people just like remap their pleasure.
What does it mean in reality? Like, how do you do that?
Yeah. So pleasure mapping in reality can be like, okay, you're with each other naked and you're like, okay, like you lay down and I'm just going to like touch different parts of your body in different ways that I feel like you like. And then they can be like, you know what, babe, I used to really like that, but I really liked it when you were like tugging on my balls.
Yes.
You know, that actually really turned me on. I'd be like, oh, really? You didn't used to like that? You know, and he'll be like, yeah, I like that now. But like, okay, that's a new thing. We're going to add that to our pleasure chest. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And like,
yeah.
And it's fun because it's not like stressful. It's like you can use it as your sexual play. It can be funny. It can be loose. It can be sexy. You know, it's just kind of what needs to happen sometimes, because especially if you're in a long-term relationship, you know, things can get a little boring. You're like, I used to love that, but not so much. You know, complications happen, right? And I always tell people, we always want to like kind of reassess pleasure with our long-term partners and even our short-term partners.
Yeah. And I think also sometimes what I feel like is that, because there's one thing when you do, when you're masturbating, okay?
Yeah.
And when you're with someone else, because that's a part of the arousal, is the fact that that person is that person that's touching you, and they're doing, you know, it's the whole energy and the vibe, and it's that exchange. Yeah. That's what sort of like makes it even more exponential. And so sometimes I feel like, yeah, dude, I just don't know. Maybe let's just explore and play. And it's not easy to find someone to just like explore and play with. And I think that's part of the fun. And because it's almost like two minds are better than one. So that's why I like your pleasure mapping idea, because sometimes they may say, they may think, you know, almost like in reverse in a way, like that, you know, they may come up with a suggestion you wouldn't have thought of that you'd like.
Exactly.
And you go, oh my God, I didn't even know. Like sometimes you have to stop and go, what is it that you're doing? So I can like tell the next person.
Exactly. but that's why pleasure mapping is so dope, because, you know, and then you can kind of morph that into like mutual masturbation. Like they can watch you masturbate, which is very hot, by the way, you know, and they can be like, wow, and they can help participate. They'd be like, wow, I didn't realize you did that. Oh, I didn't realize you liked this toy. You know, those are, and that's, and again, part of it too is the comfort level of your partner as well, right?
Yes.
Like if they're like kind of a little bit behind in terms of their own individual sexual development, sometimes that fear and that insecurity can manifest itself into like judgment or, you know, getting upset if you're like, hey, I need you to go a little bit lower when you're going down on me, or less pressure, or, you know, less wetness. Does that make sense? So, when they react that way, it has nothing to do with you and more to do with them, right? Because if I'm giving a guy a blowjob and they're like, oh, can you give me deeper? Like, can you go deeper?
Yeah.
I'm not going to take it personally. I'd be like, exactly. Oh, cool. Great. Tell me more. How can I pleasure you? Right?
Yeah, that's why I'm always surprised when people don't feel like they don't want to know. Because I'm like, personally, I don't want to be down there and be doing it, like using all my energy on trying to please you, and then you don't like it. Like, you may as well tell me,
right.
You know,
exactly.
Because it's like, why would you not want the other person to get off? It's just, So no, absolutely. I think, and I think part of it is definitely like choosing someone, whether it's like, you know, a long term or someone you're having fun with or whatever is casual, finding the partner that's a match. Because I think also one of the thing is, I don't know if that's something you come across with, you know, with your patients and stuff, but part of it, like anyway, for me is that I have to feel either like you feel loved and respected, or if it's someone casual that you can tell that they clearly just really want to pleasure the woman, that they really love the body of a woman, and it's just like really respectful of it, because you need, I sort of need that to be disrespected in a bedroom, if that makes sense. You need to be respected to be disrespected.
It depends, right? Mm. Some individuals really, really are, I'd like to say that our sexual needs, what change like over the years, you know, as we transition in time, right? Some of us need more TLC, more affection than others, depending on the time of life, the season of life that they're in. And I think that's really difficult to navigate, because that's, I think, what people run into challenges in long-term relationships sometimes, because, you know, when they went into the relationship, they were on the same page. and then life happens, and then they get on different pages. Or even if you're not in a long-term relationship, like what you responded to a few years ago in terms of sex is just not the same things that you respond to now.
Yes. Yeah.
And having tolerance for that shift, because everyone thinks that our sexuality is a static thing. And I'm like, it's so fluid in terms of what we need and what we respond to.
Yeah.
And how we respond to it. That's really the meat and potatoes of like sex education for adults, because we all think that, you know, we learned everything we need to learn when we were 16. And that's just not the case. Because I'm still learning, you know.
Yeah, like I find like the analogy for that is with food. So you may have had the same kind of food up until you were like 25 or 30, but you don't know you like pavlova cake until someone gives it to you and you think it's amazing, or yeah. Chocolate cake or salads or I don't know, or like lasagna. If you never had lasagna, you don't know if you like it until you've tried it, right? And it's like sometimes our eyes get open, we see something in a movie, or we watch some erotica, we read something, we're like, I'm feeling turned on. We're like, oh my God, I didn't know that was a thing for me. Yeah. So yeah, definitely, like, it is fluid. Now, you mentioned something about, you know, when people are in a long-term relationship, sometimes it can be hard to keep the desire alive. And I was wondering, just because I've been hearing a few podcasts around this topic around porn, and how, like, for example, if someone... Now, I'm talking about in the extremes here. I'm not talking about someone who just watched porn and, you know, just like, I have nothing against porn personally at all. But like, for example, I mean, I said that. Okay. Let me rephrase this.
Like, right.
So there are many different types of porn, but like, you know, I think, you know, like, I have nothing against porn, like, you know, but as long as people understand that's not always reality, like sex and porn are two very different things, you know, I veer more towards people like Erica Lust or Cindy Gallup, you know, even though Cindy Gallup is not porn, it's, you know, it's slightly different. But I think what I'm thinking of, like, I guess the reason behind my question is, for, let's say if someone watches porn, like regular porn, like, you know, they go on all these, I don't know, is it called RedTube or Pornhub, whatever it's called, but and they watch like porn excessively, like they just, you know, that's all the, you know, that's that they always need that to get off, or they just can't, that is so much part of them, you know, of their sexual education almost. So when someone watches porn excessively, I've heard that, you know, when you watch porn, like your brain is almost satisfied, almost like you've had sex. And so effectively, because you've satisfied that urge inside of you, it sort of decreases your desire to have sex with your actual partner. Is that something you've observed in your practice?
Yeah. You know, I've seen some of my patients who engage in, you know, excessive porn viewing. And typically I, at that point, I employ the assistance of a mental health provider, particularly a sex therapist who specializes in porn and porn addiction. And, you know, because there's a lot of controversy around, you know, if that's a thing or not. And, and what I will say, you know, because again, I'm not a neuroscientist, so I'm not the authority in terms of brain chemistry and what happens to our brain when we're looking at excessive amounts of porn. But I will say that it does create this situation where it's hard to translate sexually from what they're seeing on the screen to what is happening in reality. Yeah. And it's hard for them, their imagination and their sexual fantasies and their desires kind of be stuck in the screen, right? So that when they engage with their partner in real life, they really struggle with being able to cultivate the level of pleasure that they feel that they perceive to have when they watch porn. And that can be really devastating to both their partner and to that individual. So, you know, and again, like, we're both talking about excessive consumption of porn, right?
Yeah.
Looking at porn, you know,
for a bit of fun,
few times. Yeah. Like a normal amount, and who am I to say a normal amount, but excessive, I mean, people who are looking at it several hours a day.
Yeah.
You know? And so that can be really, really challenging. So, and it does impact your ability to your erectile function and your ability, like premature ejaculation, as well as delayed ejaculation. So those are three issues that I see arise a lot with my male clients.
And you said like they have a difficulty like cultivating pleasure with their partner.
Yeah,
what did you
with
mean
their
by
partner.
That?
Yeah, so you know when they're engaging sexually, they're it's almost like they're so used to their brain is so wired to looking at porn all the time when they masturbate that when they're having sex with their partner, they kind of don't know how to kind of focus their sexual energy with that partner.
Oh, they're not really present with their partner. They're just sort of like back in that screen mode of like back watching the porn in their mind. And so they're almost, they kind of disconnected.
Right.
Oh, that sounds awful. Yeah.
You know, and again, I'm not speaking as an authority in terms of porn addiction, but you know, from what I've seen and clinically what I've seen it manifest to from a physical standpoint, this is usually the story.
How do we discern the line between watching inspiring erotica to like having a sex drive zapper or like to having your sexuality, you know, affected by watching so much porn?
Well, you know, one of the things that I've suggested to some of my clients is to kind of do like a kind of clean break from porn just for a little bit, like just for like a week or two, you know,
to find out if it's actually doing and it has an impact to the sex life.
Yeah. And I mean, it is. And that's not, it's almost like just kind of resetting the system a little bit and then kind of going back on, like slowly bringing it back into the fold. Right. Yeah. But then using it from a sexual standpoint, like viewing, like sharing the porn that they watch with their partner. Right.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing is everyone has a right to erotic privacy. So I'm not telling them to share like their entire porn album with them.
Yeah. She probably doesn't want to either.
Right. But the things that they would like to kind of see or watch together, you know, I was like, that's totally appropriate.
So I wanted to cover a couple of more things, if you don't mind. So is this something that maybe you have come across like in your practice that, you know, sometimes when men are in love, their desire for protecting their partner can interfere with their sexual desire of really like going for it in bed, like they used to at the beginning, you know, and they have this almost kind of like this inner conflict of like the whore and the Madonna, you know, like the old fashioned way of looking at it. Do you have any tips on how to counter that? If you notice that your partner is starting to be, you know, it's nice that he's obviously wants to protect you and be so in love with you, but like, how do you get them to separate, you know, to be able to still do both, you know, love you and at the same time, like, you know, just see sex as sex?
Well, I think that one of the things that you can do to help kind of turn your partner in the direction of kind of seeing sex as sex is kind of plainly stating like, hey babe, like this is my sexual need, or it really turns me on if you were a little bit rougher, if you put your hand on my throat, or, you know, that really gets me from here to here, right? And stating plainly as to like, this is a sexual thing. This is a sexual need that I have in the bedroom, you know? And if they're talking about, oh, but that's not how you are in day to day. And I'm like, well, yeah, but that's just sex. That's just the sex I want to have with you. And I feel safe enough with you to ask you to do this, because if I didn't trust you and if I didn't love you and if I didn't feel safe with you, I wouldn't ask you to be rougher with me.
Yeah. And I guess also it's almost like giving them the permission to do it, because sometimes they may be scared to do that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think too, on the opposite scale, for people who tend to have like rougher sex and sometimes they want to have like the softer, gentler sex, you know, it's the same conflict where they're like, oh, like they, you know, this is our sexual identity, but I really do want to engage in the softer, gentler sex every once in a while, because that also turns me on.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's really just about having those conversations and getting comfortable talking about sex with your partner. And if your partner gets uncomfortable, know that is not about you and more about their own comfort level of talking with sex.
Yeah.
And just asking them, be like, is this conversation making you uncomfortable, babe? Like, how can I make it easier for you? Like, kind of gently, like, lowering them into warm bath water when you talk about this might be helpful, especially if you know that your partner isn't as comfortable talking about sex as you are.
What did you mean by bath water?
I just think just being gentle. Oh, you know? Yes.
lowering
them into lukewarm bath water instead of like a hot bath, you know?
Yeah, okay, I'm with you.
Yeah, like ease. You know,
yeah,
like,
yeah. Yeah, no, of course. Yeah. I should remember you're still talking to like another human being with their own triggers and stuff. So for sure. Okay, so this has been absolutely wonderful. I want to ask you, I always ask the two same questions to all my guests at the end of the episode. So first one is, what would you say to your 18-year-old self?
Oh gosh, okay. I'm ready for this one. I would tell my 18-year-old self, you are beautiful, you are smart, and continue to enjoy your sex life.
Yes. I love that.
Just live your best sexy life. Have as many sexual safe experiences as possible. Continue to do that.
Yeah.
That's okay to do that.
Yeah. No, that's wonderful. And the second one is, what do you not put up with anymore?
Gaslighting.
Yeah. You've managed to find like the signs when someone is gaslighting you? Because sometimes people just feel really confused inside. They're like, well, hang on, wait a minute.
Yeah, you feel crazy.
Yeah, you feel crazy.
You feel like you're insane. You're like, wait, what just happened? How am I the bad one here? Yeah, no, you feel insane.
Yeah, you're like, did you just gaslight me or am I just like completely crazy? Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, I've read some stories and they're crazy. And I have a friend as well once. She was in a long-term relationship. The guy was gaslighting her left, right, and center. And this woman actually in outside of a relationship, I wouldn't mess with her. She's very confident. She's very lovely, mm-hmm. but you know, she has clear boundaries. But when it comes to being in love, it just all went out of the window. He'd be saying things like, No, I came home last night, but I didn't want to wake you. And she clearly didn't come home. Like he was out all night, you know, messing around with someone else. And it's like, she was like, wait, maybe he did come home. <It's> like,
but that's, I mean, and I think the thing about it is it's, you know, when it comes to gaslighting, it's a form of manipulation.
It's complete manipulation.
Right? And it's a way that you manipulate people and you kind of disperse the responsibility away from yourself.
Yeah.
Instead of just owning it 100%, saying, I made this decision, I'm making this choice. You know, you blame this person, like, you know, your friend. Like, this dude was stripping somebody else all night.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of taking on the responsibility of what he did, he kind of distributed it back to her and be like, oh, I didn't want to wake you. And like,
Yeah. It was crazy. But yeah, so listen, you see, this has been so wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been great. I hope to be back soon.
Oh yeah, definitely. I'd love to. And before that, can you please tell us where we can find you?
Absolutely. You can find me on my website at www.ucelogic.com, or you can find me at UC Logic on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and hopefully on YouTube in the next few months. I also see private clients online, so I do virtual sessions. So feel free to reach out to me through my website.
Okay, I'll put all the links in the show notes. And definitely, I think YouTube will be fantastic for you, by the way. I can totally see
excited.
You. Yeah, you're going to blow it. So thank you so much, Yusi. It's been an absolute pleasure. And hopefully having you back on again.
Thank you. Have a great one.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
And that's our episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Please don't forget to rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, follow on Spotify, for all the other platforms. Whichever way you show love is how you can support this show. Drop me your questions or suggestions for future episodes via the website at angie-s.com, or come and find me on Instagram. I have two accounts. One is Too Old for This Shit Podcast and the other one is Not Too Old For with the number 4. Links in the show notes. See you next week, and until then,
years in health, inappropriately.